Good evening, everybody. My name is Chris, and I'm an alcoholic. It's good to be back up here. On the way up, I usually think it's a long ride, and I usually think, what am I going to talk about? And you know, tonight, one of the thoughts that came to me was, what barriers to recovery? What are some of the things that make it difficult for us to engage in a recovery process that will be lasting? One of the stories that I love, the person who tells this is from Southern California, and I'm stealing it, but I'm going to do that because I really like the story. Many of us have had professional treatment for addictions or alcoholism. That's not uncommon. Because alcoholism and drug addiction are so aggressive that by the time we really want to stop, many times we find we can't for some reason. For some weird reason, we change our mind somewhere along the road and we end up with drugs or alcohol back in our bodies. And it's people that have studied addictions have seen this. And then there's been a lot of things that have been developed, relapse prevention, things like that, to try to counteract some of the things that happen to us when we're back out in the real world. But the story goes like this. You're in treatment, and then you're back at home. And this is kind of what it's like. Treatment is like a big cruise liner, okay? You get on this cruise liner, and we're all together, and, you know, we've got a sense of camaraderie, and, you know, they're feeding us, and we're pretty safe, and we're pretty protected because we're on this big ship. And, you know, we're heading along, and we're doing really well. But 28 days come, or 9 months come, or 6 months come, or a year comes. You know, whenever it's time for us to be discharged, they grab us and they throw us overboard, and we're in the water. And we're treading water, you know, trying to stay afloat, and really trying to figure out how to do this, and Alcoholics Anonymous or Narcotics Anonymous or CA or any of the 12-step groups or any of the other support groups out there. You know, there's a lot of different support groups out there. What they're like is they're like a couple of guys come rowing up to you while you're treading water, and they're in an invisible boat. You just see them, but they're above water. They're doing okay, but you can't see the boat. And they say to you, you know, hop on in. And you're like, you don't understand. You don't know why this would work. Why would I want to hop in? I can't even see your boat. And this is what it's like sometimes for us when we're exposed to the 12-step fellowships. We don't understand why we need to participate. Why do I have to join up with you and show up every Friday night and, you know, make coffee and get a sponsor and get a home group? That doesn't make sense to me. You know, we're like the person treading water. And what will happen is, you know, we'll start to go down and, you know, things will get bad. And maybe we'll get desperate enough to say, okay, I'll get in the boat with you guys. I don't understand this, but I'll get in the boat. And as soon as you get in the boat, they say, okay, grab an oar and start rowing. And you're like, I don't see an oar. I don't understand. This, how can this work? But you're desperate enough, so you grab an oar and you start rowing. Now, over the course of time, the more you row, the more visible the boat becomes. The more you see that what you're doing is actually contributing to you getting out of the water. Then what happens sometimes to some of us is we get lazy, we get complacent. You know, there's a special movie on TV, or the kids need to be taken to camp, or I can't really make it to a meeting tonight. And what happens is you start to become complacent and you stop rowing. And all of a sudden the boat starts to become invisible again. And you start to really question why this is working. And you end up back in the water. The same kind of thing happens to us with 12-step fellowships or the other support groups. We don't understand why we need to do it. It doesn't make any sense. I don't want to do it. You know, I've got a life. I've got better things to do. And then we end up treading water and we end up in real trouble. Now, you know, my personal experience with alcoholism was that it got my attention so badly that I signed myself into a treatment center back in early 1989. I was absolutely desperate to separate from alcohol. I really was. It had gotten to the point where I really didn't have any life left. The people that were still in my life either pitied me or resented me. And, you know, it was a bleak, dark existence where I was always letting people down. I could never be counted on. I had a bad job, a bad friend, you know, the whole thing. So I signed myself into a treatment center, not really realizing I have a life problem. Just knowing that I need to separate from alcohol because it's killing me. So I signed myself in, and I pay attention to the best of my ability. I paid attention. And, you know, when they asked me to do an assignment, I did an assignment. When they asked me to read something, I read something. When they wanted to put me on the hot seat, I got on the hot. I cooperated. Now, I get out of this treatment center, and the suggestion was that, you know, you should go to AA. You should go to outpatient, do some outpatient. And, you know, I did the things that they told me to do that made some sense. So I signed up for outpatient. That was two nights a week. I went to two meetings a week. I figured, you know, what more do you guys want? I mean, this is four nights a week. I'm leaving the house during primetime TV, you know, going and participating in something that I really didn't like. I hated the outpatient. And I really didn't like the AA meetings because I had a lot of self-centered fear. I had a lot of anxiety. I had a lot of social phobia. It was not comfortable for me to walk into a crowded room and start glad-handing everybody. I didn't want to do that. I wanted to, like, isolate. It was part of my nature to get away from situations I found uncomfortable, not face them. You know, but I did it. And I'm going to outpatient and I'm going to meetings, but I'm not really plugging in. I'm in the invisible boat, but I'm not rowing with everybody else because I didn't understand, you know, some of the suggestions. Like, why would I get a spot? Why would I, you know, do a 90? Why would I do any of this stuff? It doesn't make sense to me. You know, you want me to show up at a meeting where I'll walk in and say hi to everybody and, you know, we'll get a cup of coffee and sit down and say the Serenity Prayer and then listen to people talk about their day and their problems and you know, put a dollar in a basket and then at the end stand in a big circle and say the Lord's Prayer. You know, I don't understand that. How can that really help? So I was just doing two meetings a week like it was castor oil treatment. I was going to the outpatient and participating in that. And about 2 months into this, after I had left treatment, I'm driving to an AA meeting and the thought crosses my mind it would be a really good idea to get a gallon of vodka. Just like that. And I think if I drink this vodka, I think it will be a good thing because I'll really remember how much I don't like drinking. And, you know, only an alcoholic would come up with something like that. So I bought a gallon of vodka and I drank it and it threw me right back into the surf. You know, I mean, now I'm going down. I'm drowning so much. And for about 5 months, I was out on a horrific, horrific relapse. Now, I almost died during my last detox, and not only that, I almost shot members of my family with a handgun. Now, this really got my attention, because it's not something I would have wanted to do in a sane state of mind. I was in an insane, blackout, violent, you know, it was just a scene. So anyway, when I detoxed from this, And the first day I could drive, because I didn't sleep for about 4 or 5 days, didn't eat, you know, I was really ill, hallucinations, you know, all the DT stuff that's so much fun. When I finally felt safe enough to pilot an automobile, I got in it and I drove to an AA meeting. I've got to tell you, I was absolutely desperate. I knew I was going to die. I had a daughter who was about 6 years old. I didn't want her to remember her dad as the alcoholic, pathetic loser, you know. I mean, that was one of the things that was kind of keeping me going. But off I went to an AA meeting. And I walked in there and I got a sponsor, like right away. And I basically placed myself unreservedly under the care and protection of Fish Food Phil, my first sponsor. I basically said, Phil, just tell me what to do, and you need to help me. I've been in hell the last couple of weeks, and I can't live there anymore. I got to get out. And he laughed a little bit, and you know, he started giving me suggestions. Now, I think the difference between why I stayed sober that time and why I didn't stay sober the first time, I tried both times. I think the difference was in my level of commitment. I just was surrendered, okay? I was at a point where I just didn't want to, I couldn't face the things that alcohol was doing to me anymore. And even if the suggestions were stupid and I didn't understand them, I grabbed the oars and I rowed. You know what I'm saying? I just did. Because I was out of plans. I was out of plans. You know, when we're finally out of plans, sometimes this thing really works for us. When we finally say, okay, I maybe I really don't know, you know. Now, what are some barriers to recovery? Now, I speak from someone who has over 19 years experience in AA. I've sponsored many people. I've worked the steps with many, many people. And I've seen people come and go. I've seen people relapse. I've seen people stay sober. And I paid very close attention to that. It would be like if you had cancer and you were all going to a clinic and some people were getting this medicine, some people were getting this medicine, and some people were being cured and some people weren't. You want to know what's working. So I've paid very, very close attention to what's worked out there over the last 19 years because self-preservation. You know, self-preservation. I don't want to die, and alcohol will kill me if it goes back into my body over any considerable period of time moving forward. So here's some of the things. Here's some of the things that I've seen that have worked. Consistency with meeting attendance. You have an incredibly higher chance of long-term recovery if you're consistent with whatever support group you want to join. If you're not a joiner, I don't really care. If you think the people at the meetings are stupid, who cares? This is about survival. You know what I mean? This is about survival. If it works, go into the meetings and you'll be able to survive addiction or alcoholism. You're just going to have to deal with whatever problems you have with the meetings or the people. So I've remained consistent over the course of the last 19 years. I go to 4 meetings a week religiously, but I do so much else. There's so many other things in my life that revolve around recovery. Now you may think this guy can't have a life. My life is unbelievably rich today. I have so many friends, it's ridiculous. I've got so many good things going on in my life. I want 50 hours in a day. I really do. It's unbelievably rich. Back when I was drinking, my life was getting smaller and smaller and smaller. There were fewer people in it every year. There was less happening every year. There was more problems every year. You know, and you go in the opposite direction when you enter recovery. Anyway, the people who are inconsistent with meetings, the people who, you know, come in strong and then dwindle away, Here's what I see happen with them. First of all, they're gone, so I don't know where they are. But many of them come crawling back into the rooms saying, oh my God, you know, it was hell out there. I picked up a drink and, you know, nothing really bad happened at first, but within a month or two, you know, I was right back where I was. And, oh, this time it was really bad. You know, I got DUIs, I lost my family. I mean, this is a weekly event for me, hearing somebody coming back and saying that. Inconsistency with the meetings. There's one thing about addictive illness. You cannot recover on your own. Irregardless of the commercials that you see on TV, you know, and the pills that they'll sell you, you really, really can't. Not if you're in real trouble with addiction or alcoholism. You're going to need a lot of help. You're going to need a lot of support. You're going to need a lot of people to stick close to you to try to help you stay enthusiastic about recovery. You're just going to need that. Now, sponsorship. I thought, you know, the first time I was in AA, I was not going to ask somebody to sponsor me. What was I supposed to do? Go up to them and say, look, you know, my life has been hell. You know, I've been making every mistake in a book. I'm living with mom. You know, my family left me. I got a bad job. You mind if I, like, call you up on the phone every day and, you know, bring you down into the bowels of my life, you know, on a constant basis? Because you look like you're doing pretty good. I thought it was like asking a guy to dance with you or something. You know, it was really, really a difficult thing for me. I didn't want to do it. I didn't want to do anything that was good for me. So the first time I didn't do it. Now, I see people who have tight relationships with their sponsors stay sober. Because if they get inconsistent with meetings, they've got a sponsor to call them up and say, hey, what's going on? What's going on? So they pretty much have to ruin that relationship to be able to scoot away, you know, slime out of the meetings and disappear. So you've got somebody watching you. Sometimes we don't know how much trouble we're in. All the time we don't know how much trouble we're in, especially when we're new. So you get a sponsor who has some authority over you in your life. You grant them spiritual consent to basically be an authority figure over you as far as recovery is concerned. You grant them spiritual consent, which means if I'm going to ask you to sponsor me, you are allowed to yell at me. You're allowed to tell me what to do. You're allowed to call me on my stuff. You're allowed to tell me if you think I'm being dishonest. You're allowed to tell me if I'm going to get in trouble because I sometimes don't know myself. So please help me with that stuff. I will try not to get mad at you, you know, when you insult me or criticize me. Now that's the spiritual consent that I give away when I get a sponsor. Most of the people with long-term recovery in any meetings I go to have a sponsor relationship. A lot of the people who disappear in the first week, month, year, decade don't have a tight relationship with a sponsor. Who should you ask to be your sponsor? I like to tell people to ask somebody who has something you want. If they seem to be happy, if they seem to have a good family life, if they seem to have a good marriage, if they seem to have a good job, if they seem to have been able to put their life back together, even being alcoholic and coming from the wreckage of alcoholism, they've been able to achieve that. Then it would behoove me to figure out, you know, find out how they did it. Tell me how you did it. You put your life back together. Things are going real good for you. You know, be my sponsor and tell me what to do, because if I do what you did, I'll get what you got. If I follow your direction, then I'll be able to put my life back together. I'll be able to rebuild the relationships in my life. I'll be able to be a good parent, you know, a good spouse, a good employee, a good employer. So that tight sponsorship aspect is highly important. It's highly important for a number of reasons. I named a few. A few others is we finally find someone that we can really be honest with. We can tell them everything. You know, we can tell them everything if they're a good sponsor. And you know what? You know what they'll do? They'll help us get through that. They'll help us grow. Character defects are very, very deep-rooted. If you're an alcoholic or if you're a drug addict, you've built a life system based on selfishness. You may not think so, but you have. Everything is about you. You can't go out there and drink and drug and raise hell and get in trouble and let your family down without coming from a place of selfishness. Now, a sponsor is a great place to start to follow the directions from the sponsor, because the sponsor is usually going to be asking you to change your behavior. He's not going to tell you to change your character defects or to change your thinking. He's going to tell you to change your behavior. He's going to be telling you to show up at the meeting and stick out your hand or make coffee or start the step work or get a service commitment. These are all things designed to pull you away from the foundation you've built on selfishness. Now, there's a line in the Big Book that says, selfishness and self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles. It doesn't say alcohol is the root of our troubles. It doesn't say drugs are the root of our troubles. It says that our selfishness is the root of our troubles. Our alcoholism and our drug addiction are built on from the roots up, are built on the foundation of selfishness. Now, it's very, very difficult to just become unselfish. Well, tomorrow I'm not going to be selfish. You know, we can't do that. It's too deeply ingrained. So our behavior has to be modified over the course of time. And a great person to help us with that is an experienced sponsor. Now, who should you ask to be your sponsor? Someone that has what you want. But you also want an experienced sponsor. Somebody that's done the step work. Somebody that's done service commitments. Somebody that's been consistent with meetings. And somebody that has some long-term recovery. Whatever that might be. So look around very, very carefully. And understand one thing. That when you ask someone to sponsor them, you're actually doing them a favor. It's not like you're asking them to come over and mow your lawn. You're asking them to do you a favor. And why is that? It's because of step 12. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics. Part of someone's recovery program is working with others. We're affording them the opportunity to complete their steps and to engage in the spiritual principle of one alcoholic helping another. You want to keep it, you need to give it away. We've all heard these things. So don't be afraid to ask somebody to sponsor you. You're actually doing them a favor. If they act like it's a big imposition, they don't understand the steps, they don't really have an experience with recovery. You're usually going to get somebody who's flattered and who appreciates it. Now, there may be some situations in their life where they can't spend the time that they need to spend with you. And if that's the case, you need to understand that and you need to move on. But sponsorship is incredibly important. Another barrier to recovery is people who don't make connections in the meetings. People who don't burrow into a home group or a set of meetings. They don't become consistent with them. They don't become loyal to them. The people that I see do this, that hit a meeting every once in a while when it's, convenient. Like, I work in New York, so I try to really hit a meeting really quick at lunch. And, that's not the type of attitude that you should have with your meetings. What you need to do, the people who stay sober over a long haul, are the people who become loyal to a home group. A home group is basically usually a meeting that has some, you can read the home group pamphlet if you want, but it's basically a meeting where you go every single week. I mean, hell or high water, you go to this meeting. And you participate in this meeting, and you know the people in the meeting, and they expect to see you. and you make friendships in these meetings, and you get phone numbers from these people, and you celebrate at these meetings, and you get commitments at these meetings, these home group meetings. Why do we need to do this? We need to do it because we're, because of our selfishness and self-centeredness, we're pre-programmed to disappear. We're pre-programmed to find something else to do, to move away from something that's uncomfortable to something that's comfortable. That's our big problem. So once we develop a relationship or relationships in these home groups, what's going to happen is we're going to start to miss it if we're not there. We're going to start to look forward to being there. We're going to start to feel enthusiastic about membership because that's where a lot of our friends are. You know, we want to bump into so-and-so, and I know so-and-so will be there. And it's just a really, really good practice to do this. You know, these are all suggestions I know everyone in here has heard. What I'm trying to do is explain why they work. And why, if you don't do them, you're seriously handicapping your chances of long-term recovery. Another thing that's unbelievably important is to work on the steps. Alcoholics Anonymous is a 12-step fellowship. Narcotics Anonymous is a 12-step fellowship. Cocaine Anonymous is a 12-step fellowship. 99% of the support groups that you're going to be able to find are 12-step fellowships. There's some out there that aren't. I know the 12-step fellowships, and I know that practicing, taking the steps and then practicing the principles is a really, really good way of rebuilding your life. I had problems with personal relationships. I had problems at work. I was always shooting myself in the foot. And I had an emotional state that was like this. I'll describe my emotional state sober but unrecovered. I would be restless. I would be irritable. I'd just be, there'd be a level of just discontent across the board. I'm just, you know, things just aren't right. I would be uncomfortable with myself in many situations. I would be uncomfortable in many environments. I didn't like going to the supermarket. You know, I mean, there's too many lights and people and carts, you know, and all this different food. I just didn't want to do it. I had a lot of self-centered fear. I certainly had a lot of guilt and shame and remorse from the way I had lived my life. These things plagued me because, you know, I always felt like I was a good person, but I did these bad things. And I always felt like a smart person, but I did these stupid things. You know, so I had a lot of guilt and shame and remorse for letting everybody down for all these years. Okay, I had depression. There would be periods of time where I just wanted to pull the covers over my head and go back to sleep. And would everybody just please leave me alone? I don't want to deal with anything today. You know, I would have tons of feeling like that. Anxiety. There were periods of time where I would have anxiety attacks. You know, I'd just be in a panic. You know, things would just freak me out. Now, here's where the steps come in. One of the things that's absolutely crystal clear to me is the people that pay attention and really work these steps, 99% of them are still around, they're still going to meetings, they're still sober. 99% of them, I'm telling you. The people who don't address these steps continue to feel emotionally depleted. There's just times where you just feel bad. And what these steps treat is they treat that emotional condition inside. You get to a point where you're not restless, irritable, and discontented. You're not depressed. You don't have anxiety. You've taken care of your amends, so you don't have any guilt, shame, or remorse. You're comfortable wherever you are. You know, you're okay wherever you are with whoever you're with. You know, you're absolutely content to have the things that you have, and you're not desperately attached to getting a whole bunch more stuff. You know, the steps center you spiritually and wake you up. It's called a spiritual awakening because you're spiritually asleep until you take these steps. And this is another thing, that it's an invisible boat because you don't understand it before you do it. It's an invisible boat. Why would these things work? It's crazy. Why would you pay the money back? Why should I have to pray and meditate? Work with other people? I can't even take care of myself. There's a million reasons why these won't work for you. And every one of those reasons is wrong. This is a program of action that actually works. So the people that look at it and say, you know, that's probably not for me, or, you know, my sponsor told me not to worry about that, those are the people who disappear from the meetings. And those are the people who never heal emotionally. They never get to the point where they just feel really good. And you can't feel bad year after year after year after year without looking for something to make you feel good. And there were periods of time when alcohol and drugs made us feel good. So you need to feel good, you know, so you don't have to use alcohol and drugs to feel good. So working the steps is vitally important, I believe, for long-term recovery. Service commitments. Why, you know, they want me to go to the jail and bring a panel into the jail. Or, you know, my sponsor wants me to be the cookie guy, you know. I mean, I used to run a bank. My sponsor wants me to be a cookie guy. Now, why do these service commitments work? The people that don't take any service commitments, that just show up at the meetings and don't get involved, a lot of times their self-esteem never rebuilds. A lot of times, because they're not giving anything back, they're not able to retain. You have to do enough work in the 12-step fellowships to get enough back to be able to stay. Does that make any sense? Now, service commitments, the people I see who get service commitments and become disciplined in fulfilling those service commitments stay around. The people who don't, a lot of times don't. They don't become a part of enough. You know, folks, this is a serious illness, alcoholism and drug addiction. And the scariest thing about this illness is, besides being progressively fatal, the scariest thing about this addictive illness is it doesn't allow you an accurate appraisal of how much trouble you're in. You're always minimizing. You know, it would be like the person who has kidney failure saying, I don't need dialysis today. I had dialysis last week, and it was a bad dialysis session. I'm not going back. That would be crazy, wouldn't it? Or somebody who has really, really bad diabetes saying, I'm not taking insulin today. I had insulin last week. It would be insane. Those illnesses allow you to see the true nature of the problem. Addictive illness doesn't. You don't have a 100% clear picture that you need to go to a meeting, you need to call your sponsor, you need to work with other people. That's not the first thing you think about. So addictive illness is scary because it's 100% recoverable from, but we don't recover from it because we don't do the things we need to do to recover from it because we don't want to or we don't think we need to. It's insane. It's an insane illness. It's really unorthodox. So by participating in all this stuff and becoming disciplined in participating in these activities, what happens is we recover from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body, alcoholism or drug addiction. We do. Everyone that does this stuff does. And you would think that they'd be banging down the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous or Narcotics Anonymous. But that's not the case. We lose as many people as we gain. As many people come into AA as leave. As many people go into NA as leave. And that's because of the unorthodox aspect of it. We just lack enthusiasm for recovery. Who the hell wants to go to a meeting? I got to call my sponsor. It's all a big hassle. So by becoming disciplined with this stuff in the beginning, you can get to a point where you can create some enthusiasm in your life for the recovery process. You go because you have to, until you go because you need to, until you go because you want to, until you go because you love to. That's what you have to do. I'll say it again. You go because you need to, until you figure out you're going because you want to. And you understand what I'm saying? Finally, you end up loving the process. You do. Most of the people that I hang out with today absolutely love recovery. It's offered them the world. It's offered them the world. Now, one of the things that I normally don't do when I'm up here is ask for, I'll be happy to field questions. Does anybody have any questions on any of the things that I talked about tonight? I'd be happy to answer questions tonight.